We'd like to welcome everyone here and call Post Council to order this January 3rd, 2019. We'd also like to excuse Robert Decker, and I believe he finished his last term. Is that correct, Sheriff? So we would definitely like to excuse him and appreciate his efforts. Additionally, we would like to welcome two new Post Council members, Chief Alan Swanson from Layton PD, and Chief Chad Soph, who is formerly from Garland PD, and congratulate him on his new position with Woods Cross PD. Additionally, we just need approval of minutes for the September 20th, 2018 minutes. Do we have a motion for approval?
So moved.
So moved. Motion by Spence Austin. Do we have a second?
Second.
Any discussion? Go ahead and call for the vote. Those in favor?
Aye.
Seeing no opposed? Passes. We'll go ahead and move to quarterly reports by Lieutenant Jacqueline and Alex Garcia.
Okay, so from September 1st, 2018 to November 30th, 2018, we received 47 total complaints, opened 26 investigations, held 3 administrative hearings, and closed 7 cases with no action after an investigation. We received 9 voluntary relinquishments. 1 was for reckless endangerment, assault, disorderly conduct. 2 was for custodial sexual misconduct. 1 was for falsification of a time card and lying under Garrity. Another was for child abuse. Another was for lewdness and lying under Garrity, enticing a minor. Another was for sexual assault, BCI violation, and the last was for possession of child pornography. We reviewed 160 basic training applications, 26 dispatcher applications, 32 waiver and reactivation applications. Our current caseload is 62 active investigations with 71 open investigations. Any questions? Thanks.
Good morning. So this is going to cover the same time frame, September 1st of 2018 to November 30th, 2018. On September 27th, 2018, we had LEO class 336 start with 37. They graduated on the 27th with 36 completing the LEO certification, one of them resigning due to a medical injury that occurred at the academy. Class 337 SFO started July 16th and went to August 23rd. With 28 starting SFO and 25 completing SFO. One of them was departed for a cadet decision, and the other one was an agency decision. 337 LEO started August 27th, graduated October 25th. They started with 33, and all 33 graduated LEO. 338 started August 6th, graduated 338 SFO, graduated September 13th. They started with 29, 26 completed SFO. 3 were departed for the following reasons. 1 was a cadet decision. 1 was dismissed. Didn't have a completed or passed NPOS score prior to the 5th week. And another one was dismissed based off of not passing the certification examination. 338 LEO. September 17th to November 15th, they started LEO with 41. 39 completed LEO. 2 of them were departed. Both of them were cadet decisions to leave. 339 SFO, August 27th to October 4th. They started SFO with 30 and 27 graduated SFO. 3 were departed. 1 was a cadet decision and 2 were agency decisions. 339 LEO started October 9th and graduated December 6th. They started with 40, graduated 38. 2 were departed, 1 was for a cadet decision, and the other one was an agency decision. 340 SFO started November 13th and finished SFO December 20th. They started with 14, 13 completed SFO, and one of them was dismissed based off physical fitness. So our upcoming classes, January 7th, we have 341 LEO starting, and that is a full class with 40 cadets. 342 will start February 11th, and there are currently 37 cadets enrolled in that class. We did combine a second January class with our February class, and we moved that start date up to February 11th. So we didn't have the numbers to hold the January 22nd class, and the numbers in the February 25th class were low, so we just combined those, and we're sitting at 37 right now. As far as in-service goes, there were a total of 34 in-service classes offered, 512 officers graduating or getting credit for those hours, and also 22 dispatchers. There was a total of 456 hours of training. We had a basic dispatcher course, defensive tactics instructor phase two, defensive tactics instructor recertification, an EVO basic course, two of those, one handgun instructor course, three instructor development courses, four intoxilizer operator certification courses, two recertification courses for the intoxilizer, and online certification for intoxilizer. There were also three. Radar LIDAR operator certification, there were three. Radar LIDAR operator recertification, there were six. Radar LIDAR operator online recertification, three. And then the sexual assault investigations online training. There was one of, or that was the advanced sexual assault class, sorry, and there were 31 enrolled in that for one class. So, any questions as far as the basic training in service or our numbers, anything like that? All right, I'll just move on to the next one then. That'll be the Satellite Academy audits. Three of those were conducted this quarter to round out all of the satellites being audited for this year. Utah Valley University, Salt Lake Community College, and Dixie State were all audited. There were no exceptions. Things seemed to be going fairly smoothly with the satellite academies. A lot of them are seeing lower numbers now. Usually we tend to see that anyway. The economy's good. There's jobs out there. Unemployment rate's low, so enrollment tends to decline. So any questions? Thank you.
Thank you. Now move to Tooele Technical College Academy proposal. Sheldon Richens. Okay.
Good morning. Some booklets are being passed around just to illustrate what we have been doing out in Tooele. I am Sheldon Riches. I've been hired by the Tooele Technical College to head up the police academy out there. I brought with me Director of Nursing and Allied Health, Tracy Schaefer. She's actually my supervisor from out there. I was hired with them October 15th of last year. Prior to that, Tracy had met with several entities out there in Tooele County to find out if there was a need for a satellite academy in Tooele. And that footwork started on July 26, 2018. And so she met with all the different police agencies out there, and also county commissioners and human resources from Tooele City and Tooele County. And they all, in those meetings, they come to a consensus that it would be a good idea to have a satellite academy out there. Excuse me. From that point, she began the footwork to find out who would be the best person to head up this. And like I said, they hired me on October 15th. At that time, I went to work meeting with department heads, many leaders throughout the community, trying to find out what would be the best route and how could we perform this. To keep my time short here, in Utah Office of Administrative Rules, it's R728-401-5. It says approval of Satellite Academy. And in your booklets, we have compiled this. I just want to run down really quick. And number one, it says a law enforcement agency, correctional agency, or an institution of higher learning that meets the conditions and requirements. And it goes on into more detail. This is a Tooele Technical College is an institution of higher learning, and they have been approached by Utah State University to see if we can get the approval to hold a satellite academy out there. A little bit about myself. I'm retired from the Highway Patrol after 27 and a half years. I've been retired for a year and a half, and during my career, me personally, I think it was a very, very challenging career, but also a very wonderful career. And you can see some of my credentials in there that Tracy has provided. I also met on October 23rd. I met with Director Stevenson, Captain Kelly Sparks, and Lieutenant Alex Garcia here at Post to see what we needed to do. And from that point, I went around meeting with other individuals here at Post and other satellite academies to help find out what needed to take place. And number two, little B, little I, says no satellite academies within 30 miles. There is no satellite academy from Tooele. I mean, the closest one is 44 miles. That is Salt Lake Community College here. So we fall within that. If we go down to double little I, law enforcement agency in the county or region has requested in writing. And so in the booklet that you have, there are at least three letters from the different agencies out there requesting that we have a satellite academy out there. Roman numeral 4, little IV, the entity will provide a unique or specialized training program. Okay. Right there, we are looking to hold the SFO, the BCO, and the LEO courses and trying to gear up for the 2021 prison opening, trying to assist Department of Corrections on that front there. And then number 3, little I, it talks about the approval of council may authorize an entity to operate a satellite academy if the entity demonstrates there is a need for additional training programs. And little A talks about in the county or region where the proposed satellite academy is to operate. There have been many officers, department heads have come to the college and asked if we would offer in-service classes. We will gladly do that once we get the satellite academy up and running with the approval of this council here. And then it goes into the rules and regs, also goes into procedures or for course validations. And in your booklets, I have gone through there and documented different types of things. One thing I want to point out is the Tooele Technical College has a media center or a testing center, which we have gotten the approval to hold the end post out there, and we have personnel out there working to get that up and running. And as a matter of fact, it is right now at this point, it's up and running. I'm not certain at this time if that has been communicated to post here or not. With that, I know my time is short, and so I'll just ask if there's any questions, if any of you have any questions for me at this point.
Any questions for Mr. Riches? not, we appreciate your proposal, and we need to call for a motion to approve Peace Officer Standards and Training Satellite Academy in Tooele. If I have a motion?
So moved.
I have a motion from Colonel Rappage. Do I have a second?
Second.
Second from Spencer Austin. Any further discussion? Seeing none, we'll call for the vote. Those in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
Thank you. Appreciate your time. Ms. Vitti, if you're here, we'll go ahead and start with disciplinary cases.
Council members, good morning. Good morning. Our first case today is Brian Cunningham. Mr. Cunningham, are you here? Okay. Mr. Cunningham, the sustained charge was falsification or alteration of a government record. He was an officer with Utah Valley University Police. He had 10 years of service. Post is recommending 1.5 year suspension, and the guidelines call for a baseline of 1 year suspension. He does have an aggravating factor that he has a previous post suspension for DUI in 2014. On or about September 6, 2017, Brian Cunningham accessed his department time management system to sign off duty using his home internet and claimed full amount of time worked. He lives approximately 40 minutes outside his work jurisdiction and did not have a take-home law enforcement vehicle. On or about September 17, 2017, Cunningham accessed the time management system to sign on duty 3 hours earlier than his scheduled shift using his home internet and claimed more than his approved amount of work hours. During a Garrity interview with the investigating agency, Cunningham stated there were times he had gone home and checked off duty with the internet. I'm sorry, with the intent to readjust his time. Cunningham was asked if he had adjusted his time on the days he left early, and he said he thought he had adjusted his time. Cunningham was again asked if he had actually adjusted his time, not just thought he adjusted his time, and Cunningham said the investigation showed he had not adjusted the time. Cunningham told the investigators they both knew where the investigation was going, and he would be losing his job over this. Cunningham resigned from UVUPD on November 30th. He did not participate in the post-investigation.
Thank you. I don't see any counsel as well. We have any counsel for Mr. Cunningham? Seeing none, I'll call for a motion.
Move to accept the.
Move to accept. Move to
second. It.
Second from John Crowley. We have any further discussion? Call for the vote. Those in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
Next.
Okay, the second case is Kevin Fuller. Mr. Fuller, are you here? You're welcome to come up. If you wish to address, it's up to you if you wish to address the council. Are you represented? Okay. So Kevin Fuller was an officer with the West Jordan Police Department. The sustained offense was lying under Garrity. Post is recommending revocation. The allegations were sustained after a hearing before an administrative law judge. He was terminated from his agency on April 24th, 2017. There are no aggravating factors and no mitigating factors. He was with his department for 18 years. He was a peace officer for 18 years. On March 20, 2013, Kevin Fuller assisted an outside police agency with the execution of a search warrant. During the execution of the warrant, Fuller seized property he believed was associated with cases within his agency. On April 8, 2013, Fuller completed a report documenting the execution of the warrant and identified the property as found property with no owner information. Since there was no owner information attached to the property in the report, the property was subsequently destroyed or sold. On April 8, 2014, 1 year after the original report was written, and after becoming aware the property had been inappropriately destroyed, Fuller accessed the original report and added the owner's name to the involvement section of the report. Fuller also inserted the owner's name to the narrative of the report. On January 10, 2017, during a Garrity interview with his agency, Fuller admitted he had added the name of the individual to the involvements section of the report, but denied making any changes to the actual narrative of the report. During the Garrity interviews with Post, Fuller said, based on the record management system log information provided to him, he was 99% certain he made changes to the report, but did not recall doing so. On October 2, 2018, a hearing was held before the administrative law judge. The administrative law judge subsequently issued findings of fact and conclusions of law stating that Officer Fuller violated Utah Code 536211 as outlined in the Notice of Agency Action. And the baseline for this offense is revocation.
That's Mr. It. Fuller, would you like to...
I want to thank each of you for taking the time to hear me today. And the past couple of years have been a whirlwind of unexpected hardships, lessons forced to be learned, and the hardest part of it all was watching my wife and seven children have to suffer the results of these circumstances. I've been consistently trying to explain what occurred in the internal affairs interview with Lieutenant Sanders, and I've been trying to explain who I am as a person, defending my reputation and to prove that I am not a liar. I have broken it down to show that I was not dishonest all along. Everything I have said regarding this investigation was the truth. The Post investigator said my motive for lying was so I would not get in trouble or possibly be fired. But then they found during this investigation that I went to my supervisor during this time. And this was 3 years prior to this investigation. I did not lie. I was merely mistaken about a case 4 years prior. And I remembered inaccurate information. I'm saddened and devastated as my honorable career has been tarnished and discarded because I did not remember what occurred in a report that I wrote 4 years prior. Everything I stand for, my hard work and efforts, all disregarded because of inaccurate information. During all of this investigation, it has sparked a memory from my childhood when my mom asked me if I had put the dishes away dirty. I told her no, and she hit me. She did not believe me. I told her the truth, and she hit me again. My nose was bleeding. My mom was determined to get a yes answer out of me, and I then lied to her and told her that I did put the dirty dishes away. She forced the answer she wanted and not the truth. This process has made me feel much like I did as a kid, questioned over and over. I tell the truth, and then I get beat down. I tell the truth again, and another hit down. However, the difference between today and when I was a child, I will not lie to get out of trouble. I stand here today speaking from my soul. That I did not lie. I was simply mistaken. This investigation has been the same as the days when my mom did not believe me. I may not be getting beat down literally, but emotionally, I'm beat, I'm battered, and my reputation is being tarnished by the allegations. I've been compared by the Post attorney to President Nixon in the Watergate scandal. I have been constantly called a liar. This investigation has taken nearly 2 years, and the things said about me have been very difficult to hear. During all of this time, I read motivational books and try to stay motivated. Excuse me. And I read a book by William George Jordan, and this applies today, but it was written back in the late 1800s. And he said the second most deadly weapon is the dynamite gun, and the first is the human tongue. The tongue kills reputations and oftentimes ruins characters. Theft and murder are awful crimes, yet in any single year, the aggregate sorrow, pain, and suffering they cause in a nation is microscopic when compared with the sorrows that come from the crimes of the tongue. He said it is strange in life that we recognize the right of every criminal to have a fair, open trial, yet we condemn unheard the family and friends around us on mere circumstantial evidence. There are circumstances of Lieutenant Sanders, compelling a confession and forcing an immediate memory of a case that occurred 4 years prior. I answered all his questions upon immediate memory, and I was inaccurate about some of the details in the case. I remembered them differently than what was shown occurred. My memory was flawed. I told this to West Jordan Post investigators and judge, and I am still being called a liar. It brings me right back to when my mom was adamant that I lied. But I will say again that I am telling the truth. If this council is wondering if I have learned from this investigation, I want each of you to know that I have spent many nights lying awake, pondering, praying, wondering how can I show that I was simply mistaken about an addition I made to my report 4 years prior. I also want you to know that the past couple of years I've learned so much about the strength of my family and my children and my friends around me. I've been humbled by the support from my coworkers and my neighbors and my family. I've learned different jobs and trade work to help keep the family afloat. I currently wash windows to help pay the bills, and as I would do whatever I can to continue to show my children what having integrity and honor is all about. I want them to see that no matter what the world says or does to you, to not give up and to continue to do your best, be honest, and remain humble. I believe my family has learned more about sacrifice as bills and credit cards have maxed out. Our debt-to-income ratio has raised. 800-plus credit scores have slowly declined. My wife, who suffers with physical lifelong ailments, has sacrificed to get a job and help the family survive. All seven of our children have given what they can help out or to go without. We've made adjustments. We found renters to help pay for rent so that we don't lose our home. And I just want to say I miss serving the community. I miss being with the people of whom I worked in the West Jordan City. So the answer is yes. I have learned so much and believe that I am a better, more empathetic man having gone through this. And I just want to thank the council for meeting with me today and just request that I be able to get back to police work. I have just a short time left in my career, and I plan to use those years wisely and make a difference. I ask and plead with the council to please not take my police certification away, and I humbly ask for anything less than a revocation and a credit for the time I have been out of police work.
Any questions for Mr. Fuller?
Sheriff Noel? The item that we're discussing is a $30,000 vase, is that right? Is that what we're talking about? That you, in 2014, you recovered that, is that right?
No.
Tell me what happened.
The vase in question, the suspect that was arrested for this, it was a motor vehicle enforcement case. So the suspect that was arrested, there was a $30,000 vase in a case that I was dealing with in West Jordan. The picture of that vase was not known at the time. So when I went to the house, there were a whole bunch of Middle Eastern items, and I recovered the Middle Eastern items thinking it's going to belong to this case. But I hadn't got a hold of the military personnel because he was overseas. And so we didn't have a picture of it or anything. So the $30,000 vase did not exist in this case. It had nothing to do with this case at all. The suspect, the Motor Vehicle Enforcement put in their case that we were looking for a $30,000 case in one of our cases, a vase in one of our cases. And then that's when the suspect said, oh, there was a $30,000 case. And that's when she made the complaint that we destroyed a $30,000 vase.
So the items that you put back into the Spillman evidence in 2018, why did you do that? Why did you come back 4 years later and re-put those into Spillman?
Okay, so the original items of evidence, they were booked, and they were booked properly during 2012, I believe, the 2012 case. So that, again, has nothing to do with it, and that's what kind of is frustrating on my part, because I'm getting fired for lying, but then they're saying, well, a $30,000 vase went missing, and so I'm not being basically charged for lying. I'm being basically charged for making a $30,000 vase disappear, when that's just not true. The property that was booked, where there were a lot of Middle Eastern items, including vases. I remember there was a rug. There were a lot of coins.
Those were stolen out of a burglary?
Yes, from a storage unit that a military guy had. And that was a case 2 months prior. And it wasn't even my case, but I remembered the detective talking about it. And that's why I went out to the house to look for those items.
Additionally, my question would be, when you went in and you changed the narrative, why didn't you just add a supplement after having discovered that the property did have an owner?
So Spillman shows that I added the name Sheila France into the narrative. I don't remember doing that, but Spillman shows that I did. So that's why I said, well, then I probably did it. I just don't remember doing that. And that's where they're saying I'm lying.
I have a question about the timing. So search warrant was executed in March of 13, and you did your report April 8th of 13, right? The initial report.
Yes, I believe so.
And then you get the call from Bountiful PD on April 1st of the following year.
Of 2014.
And then 7 days later, that's when the changes are made.
Yes.
And so I guess what I'm slightly unclear about is, are you denying that you made the changes?
No.
Okay. And you remember all the other things about the warrant, the report, the investigation, but you don't remember going in and making the changes?
I remember changing certain parts of the case. I remember changing the involvements and adding Sheila France's name into the involvements.
Why during the Garrity interview, on January 10th, 2017, did you indicate to the lieutenant it had not been altered, I didn't change anything in the original form? Because that seems to be the basis.
That I remembered, yes.
So now you remember doing it, but at the time of the Garrity interview, which was a month after they kind of informally put you on notice that this was an issue, you didn't remember at that time.
So no, when the Garrity interview happened, that is when I had to go off of complete memory from a four-year-old case.
What about the
Garrity interview with Wes Jordan?
Well, it said that on December 14th of 2016, there was informal contact. Miranda wasn't issued. Garrity wasn't issued. So it appeared that you were on notice at that point, and then they pulled you in on January 10th, about a month later, and gave you Miranda and Garrity. So it doesn't seem like the January 10th statements would have been this out-of-the-blue, kind of cold, come in and talk to us about this case.
Yeah, it was, from what I understood, it was completed because I told them all the information on the January 5th, and then they had a Garrity interview on January 10th. Is that what you're asking?
Well, no, what I'm saying is it appears that on December 14th, 2016, Lieutenant Sanders interviewed you without a Garrity warning. On December 14th.
Yes, there was one interview. He asked me to start recalling what happened in this case.
So then the Garrity interview is done approximately a month later. So you've had a month to think about this.
Or a month to forget about it, yes.
So it just wasn't, you just thought that this is a statement.
I thought it was over after I told him everything that happened. Like, he asked me the same exact questions in the Garrity interview as well, and he got the same exact answers.
Chief Silk, did you have another question?
Did you receive the call from the Bountiful Police Department, or was it your supervisor?
So from Bountiful, I received the call.
So is that what stoked your memory or made you recall that you had put them in as a complainant and involvement?
Yes, and that's when I went to my lieutenant and informed him of exactly what, how bad the report was and what I failed to do.
Can it tell you to put it in involvements now, or did you just do that on your own?
He told me to go back and fix the report, okay. And I did.
Okay.
As a follow-up to that, was there any contact from Post on that particular issue with Lieutenant?
With Lieutenant?
Yes.
Yeah, I can address these issues. Yeah.
You'll have an opportunity to, if we're done with questions. Any further questions for Mr. Fuller? Seeing none, Ms. Beatty.
So I'll address your question first. We did interview, if I can put this in the record, may I address that specific question?
Absolutely.
We did interview his supervisor, who said he did tell him to address the issue, but didn't tell him to alter the original report. I think all law enforcement officers here know that that's pretty, that's common. That you rate a supplemental. No one here thinks otherwise, I don't think, in this room. If I may read some of the findings of fact from the judge's opinion, would that be possible to clarify the record? Just to have the dates accurate, and I think Victoria clarified it to a great extent, but I'll just clarify it a little bit more, that on or about March 30th, 2013, Fuller assisted officers from another agency with the execution of a warrant. During the execution of the warrant, Fuller seized several items he believed may have been related to a burglary case being investigated by West Jordan. On April 8th, 2013, he filed a report for the incident in the West Jordan PD Spillman Records database and filed a West Jordan PD property report listing the name as found property. On April 1st, 2014, the Bountiful Police Department called Fuller to inquire about the property in the case, as the owner was attempting to reclaim the property that Fuller had booked as found property on April 8th, 2013. Fuller then inquired with West Jordan PD evidence and found that half the property had been destroyed or sold to surplus. And then I drop down to paragraph 6. On April 8th, 2014, Fuller accessed Spillman system and added the name of the property owner to the narrative of his original report that had been filed on April 8th, 2013. Now I'm going to skip forward to page 6 of the judge's opinion, starting with the top of the page. These are the findings of the administrative law judge. Clearly, Fuller statements that he had not altered the narrative portion of the original report and that it had always contained the property owner's name were false. Also, it is not likely or believable that he could not remember or was mistaken about altering the report. During both interviews, Fuller remembered many details of the incident and his follow-up actions. He was able to remember the conversations at the scene, who was present, and where they were in the house during the serving of the warrant. He could describe much of the evidence he seized, etc. At the beginning of the Garrity interview, he stated he had reviewed the reports and had, and quote, had been thinking about it a lot, end quote, in trying to remember everything he could about the case. Finally, he volunteered a particularly telling statement during the Garrity interview. He told Lieutenant Sanders that he showed Lieutenant Schober, that would be his supervisor, and Lieutenant Sanders would have been the IA, the investigating lieutenant. He told Lieutenant Sanders that he showed Lieutenant Schober in April 2014 that the name was in the original report narrative. Lieutenant Schober was inquiring about the missing property at the time. This is a key statement because April 2014 was the same month that Fuller changed the narrative by adding the property owner's name. Since Lieutenant Schober's conversation and Fuller's alteration of the report would have happened literally within days of each other, Fuller certainly would have known he changed the narrative when he told Lieutenant Schober the name was in the original report in 2014. Either he was not telling Lieutenant Schober the truth in April 2014, or he never had that conversation with Lieutenant Schober and is not being truthful in the Garrity interview. In either case, it's an indication Fuller was being deceptive with respect to what was in the original report and his alteration of that report. That's all I'm going to read from the judge's opinion, and I wouldn't normally address this, but with respect to me comparing him to Richard Nixon, he misunderstood my comment during my closing argument. My closing argument was that, as in many of these cases, it's not the crime, it's the cover-up, as in Watergate.
Any questions for Ms. Beattie?
Yes, sir. Yes.
Investigation. So now you're saying that he changed the narrative.
Well, I'm just reading you.
He added the name into the narrative.
Just to be clear, I'm just reading you the judge's opinion.
I understand that. What you found out by him adding the name into the narrative, what is the reasoning that he did that? What did you find in your investigation that he did that? Did he do it so he wouldn't get in trouble? Did he do it because evidence was destroyed? Did he do it because it was stolen? What was the reasoning for him to do that?
Yeah, I don't think that's something that would be purely conjecture, and that's not a finding in this. So I don't think that's something that I could give you. That would be my opinion. I don't think it's appropriate, Mr. Chairman.
Agreed.
Yeah. Sorry.
I think it's extremely important.
Well, that's
going
to be we could go back to the.
Right. That's an opinion, but we can't address my opinion here. We can only address what the findings are. That's what this body considers at this point.
And there's nothing in the findings about whether he was directed to do that or not?
Sheriff Noel. Yeah. We could ask the investigator what the findings were specific, but not what their opinion is.
Okay. What were the findings to that?
I believe Jeremy Barnes post investigations. I believe the findings are the timeline. The findings are the fact that he was contacted by Bountiful on April 1st about an issue. He went back and on April 8th made the change to the narrative. As far as the motive, as Ms. Beattie said, it's all conjecture or assumption. But the findings are he changed the narrative after being contacted by Bountiful Police Department. The narrative was changed. There was not a supplemental report. The original narrative of the report was changed with his logon information.
So you see somebody's property, not knowing whose it was, but you see somebody's property on March 30th, and then you did not write a report till April 8th. So where was that property for 9 days?
For 9 days, so I had some time off in there and then the weekend. So it was approximately 6 to 9 days where it wasn't booked. So the property was either locked in the drawer or locked into the sergeant's office, or it could have even been locked into the lieutenant's conference room.
That's standard protocol to see someone's property and not do a report on it for that long and not book the
report should have been done before that. I don't know if it was because of the time off. I don't know. So I admitted to all that. I admitted to doing all that wrong. However, the property being booked was booked properly. There are many cases where we'd hold on to property for nearly a month because we're trying to find the owners of who it belongs to and trying to get it back. We've had motorhome cases where the entire motorhome is full of stolen property, and it's just impossible to book all that property in one day. So you go through it and find out who it belongs to, list them as victims in the report, and then book it. And sometimes that takes quite a while. And I think it is standard to do that, especially in property crimes. If it comes to money and drugs, you book it the same day.
Why did you list it as stolen property?
Great question. I even post asked me that. My West Jordan officer investigator asked me that, and I don't know. I don't know why I listed it found property, because when I went back to change it, like, why didn't I list it as assist agency in the first place? Because that's what it was. I even put down the station's address, which was just wrong. I should have put down the suspect's address. I had literally no involvements of people in the report. I only had all the property in the report. And when it came back up a year later, that's when I went to my lieutenant and says, look, half his property is already gone because it's gone from evidence going through their protocol and getting rid of it. And I'm missing all this information. And that's when he said, go fix it. And there was no argument in regards to that. The lieutenant said that possibly could have happened as well.
That was your lieutenant at the time, Schober?
Lieutenant Schober at the time, yes.
Yeah, I can address that. I don't think we have any. Excuse me, sir. I don't think there's anything indicating that Lieutenant Schober said he might have told him to change the report. That's not factually accurate.
Can I address that?
No, I think at this point we...
They had a witness, Randy Girona, who confirmed it.
Okay. Mr. Chairman, I think at this point we're rehashing the facts, which is not a function of this body. I think at this point I would ask that maybe we start to wrap this up. Instead of retrying or rehearing this case, this body's function is to consider sanction, not to decide whether or not the facts that the administrative law judge found are accurate.
Correct. Any further questions specific to the case itself? Seeing none, I'll call for a motion.
Can I say one more thing just real quick?
Go ahead.
I just wanted to answer his question is, there is no motive. I went to my lieutenant. I would have been in trouble at that time. There is no motive, and that's why I'm not understanding this, and I'm telling the truth about all of it. I just wanted to add that.
Thank you. We have a motion.
I'd like to make a motion that we accept the recommendation. I think that the investigation showed clear and convincing evidence that the report was altered regardless of the memory. Spillman does keep track of all entries, logins, changes. I think it meets the level.
We have a motion from Sheriff Corey Pulsifer to accept the recommendations from Post. Do we have a second?
I'll second.
We have a second from Director Haddon. Any further discussion? Any further discussion? Sheriff?
The case that we're here about, Sheriff, is we're here about lying under Garrity. We're not here about the report. We're here about whether or not he lied under Garrity. Am I right? That's not what we're here about, is the report or that. And I don't think there is clear and convincing evidence that he did lie under Garrity. I'm not gonna support that. What I do support is that he did a piss poor job on the report, and he took some steps on the thing that he shouldn't have done, and I don't believe that he lied under Garrity.
So if I'm following the process correctly, I'm still probably one of the newest people here. They had an ALJ hearing to resolve that, to establish whether or not that actually occurred. In that ALJ hearing, they concluded that the violation did occur. I think it's difficult for us now to try to go back and...
The lying under Garrity violation occurred?
Yes. It's probably difficult for us now to go back and try to rehash that hearing and make a different conclusion of what came up in that hearing. Tell me if I'm wrong.
Well, I think that we are, as Ms. Vitti said, a sentencing body. But I think this is where it gets a little bit difficult, is because all the facts that essentially gave rise to the ALJ's determination can also be considered aggravating or mitigating factors in how we determine how we're going to handle this. And so I think that even within the ALJ's finding, I think that there's probably some members that can agree that maybe they wouldn't have come to the same conclusion because they see more of the mitigating factors, whereas other members may disagree and say, no, you know, based on this timeline, we think that there's maybe, on the other hand, aggravating factors. So I think as long as, for record purposes, that we're clear that we're here for sentencing and any of the factual considerations, it's more of a issue of mitigating or aggravating, then we're probably in the correct posture.
I'd like to offer a substitute motion that we do. It's a 4-year suspension.
Second.
So we have a substitute motion from
Frank Budd for a 4-year suspension and a second from Christy Morin for a 4-year suspension. Any further discussion? Seeing none, we'll call for the vote. Those in favor?
Aye. We're voting on my motion.
Correct. On your motion. Any opposed? Opposed. One, Mike Haddon.
Opposed.
And Bruce Bailey. And Sheriff Corey Pulsifer. Did I miss anybody? We'll go ahead and we already voted on that, so we're good. We're good. Okay, thank you. Appreciate it. Speedy.
I'm sorry, we have one more issue on this particular case.
Go ahead, Ms.
Lieutenant. Moore is going to address.
Sorry, Mr. Fuller requested he get time served. I was just wondering.
That's how it will be applied.
From
his separation.
From his, okay. That's all.
Is Scott Garrett or is counsel here? I see no one rising. Ms. Beattie?
Scott Garrett, the sustained charge was willfully falsifies any information to obtain a certification, a Category C offense. Post recommends a 2-year suspension. There are no aggravators, no mitigators. The guidelines call for a baseline of a 2-year suspension. On October 17, 2017, Scott Garrett applied for peace officer training to obtain certification. Garrett marked no to all questions which asked if he ever used methamphetamine or had been involved in a crime involving unlawful use, possession, or sale of a controlled substance. On May 17, 2018, Garrett participated in a pre-employment polygraph exam and disclosed he had used methamphetamine almost daily from March 2012 until September 2013. Garrett also disclosed he had given his prescription to friends at high school and sold methamphetamine 3 times. During a Garrity interview with Post, Garrett said he completed his application and did not understand why he did not disclose his methamphetamine use in his Post application. He failed to respond to the notice of agency action, and an order of default was signed in this case.
Any questions for Ms. Beattie? Seeing none, call for the motion.
Motion to accept.
Motion to accept, John Crowley. Second by, was that Chief Swanson? All those in favor?
Aye.
Any opposed? Thank you.
The next case is Kenneth Hammond.
Martha. It's Martha.
Oh,
Gonzalez.
I'm sorry. I apologize.
Is Martha here or her counsel?
I'm looking at the old form. Sorry.
I see no one rising.
Martha Alejandra Gonzalez. The sustained charge was driving under the influence, a Category D offense. Post is recommending a 1-year suspension, which is the baseline in the guidelines. She had 22 years of service. She had been with the Box Elder County Sheriff's Office. She did plead guilty to a misdemeanor in Idaho, which is where this occurred, which is the equivalent of our Class B misdemeanor. She was terminated by her department on August 23, 2018. The sustained allegation was DUI. On June 25, 2018, Martha Gonzalez was pulled over for a vehicle backing violation in Idaho. The Idaho police officer suspected Gonzalez of driving under the influence of alcohol. Gonzalez admitted to consuming 3 draft beers and numerous cans of beer earlier in the evening. The officer had Gonzalez perform the standardized field sobriety tests and submit two breath tests. Gonzalez's breath alcohol content was measured at 0.113 and 0.114. Gonzalez was arrested and booked into the county jail for DUI. An internal administrative investigation was conducted on Gonzalez by her department, which sustained the allegation of DUI. On August 23, 2018, Gonzalez's employment was terminated. In September, Gonzalez pled guilty to a criminal charge of DUI in a Idaho court. During the Garrity interview with Post, Gonzalez stated, "The evidence is there. I take full responsibility for the decision I made, and it was a bad decision." She waived her right to a hearing.
Any questions? Seeing none, I'll call for the motion.
Those in favor?
Aye.
I'll make a motion.
Sorry about that.
Yeah, I'll make a motion.
Okay. If we have a motion, John Crowley, we have a second from Chief Silk. Those in favor?
Aye.
Any opposed? Yeah. Thank you.
Okay, in the next case, Kenneth Hammond, Mr. Hammond, and his attorney are both present.
Right.
Kenneth Hammond had been with the Davis County Sheriff's Office and had 27 years of service. The sustained charge, after an administrative law judge heard the case, was assault. This is a Category C offense with a guidelines baseline of a two-year suspension, and Post is recommending a two-year suspension. There are no aggravators and no mitigators. On or about July 7th, 2017, he resigned. On or about July 1st, 2017, Kenneth Hammond took it upon himself to provide unauthorized defensive tactics training to a civilian employee. During this training, Hammond punched the civilian employee in the upper right side of her chest. During a Garrity interview with Post, Hammond admitted he conducted unauthorized defensive tactics training with the civilian employee and punched her in the upper right side of her chest. Hammond said he could not remember the exact wording the civilian employee gave him as consent, but he said it was definitely implied because the civilian employee asked, "If you hit me, will it knock me out?" During interviews with Post, the civilian employee said she did not give consent for Hammond to punch her. The witness who observed the unauthorized training said he did not believe the civilian employee did or said anything that Hammond would perceive as consent to train her. On November 7, 2018, a hearing was held before the administrative law judge. The administrative law judge subsequently issued findings of fact and conclusions of law stating that Hammond had violated Utah Code Section 53.6.2011. And I believe Mr. Hammond and his attorney would both like to address this body.
Mr. Hammond or counsel?
My name is Rich Willey. I represent Kenny Hammond. this case is just a little bit, it's just going to be a little bit odd. And the reason is you guys have already touched on it just a little bit in one of the earlier rulings today. But we have two issues that I'd like rulings on today. And the first one relates to the appeal that is currently at the Court of Appeals. We have appealed the ALJ's findings of facts and conclusions of law. And we've also asked the Court of Appeals for a stay on today's motion. Now, the Court of Appeals has not ruled on either of those motions yet, what I'd like to ask the counsel to do is rule on whether to stay this proceeding until the resolution of the Court of Appeals hearing. I think there's some good reasons to do that. We've already kind of established today that the findings of facts and conclusions of law of the ALJ are not we can't rehash them today. The post counsel does not review them for correctness, So when officers stand before you, they're really just arguing on the facts of the ALJ. There's case law discussing this issue, and what the case law says is it says because of the nature of agency proceedings, final actions often take the place seritum, and seritum just means in series, disposing completely of discrete issues in one order while leaving other issues for later orders. Such orders will be final as to any issue fully decided by that order. Now, what I'd propose to you is that the ALJ's findings of fact and conclusions of law are final. We're not going to reconsider them today. So under this prior case law, I believe it is immediately appealable. As such, I believe that the Utah Court of Appeals has jurisdiction over this case until they hear it. So, Mr. Chairman, if you wouldn't mind, I'd like a ruling on whether or not we could stay these proceedings until the resolution of the case at the Court of Appeals.
Counsel, I'll defer to Mark Ishaki, our legal counsel.
So, post counsel is aware of the motion for the stay. Also, for the post counsel's attorney is also aware of the matter that is before the Court of Appeals. In regards to this, I don't believe that my instruction to the counsel would be I don't believe this is a final order. The ALJ's decision is a final order. If we look and looking through U.S. So UAPA, which is Utah Administrative Procedures Act, and also the statute and the rule, all of which, so if we're looking at post-statute, which is 536.211, it provides that the matter will be, after the ALJ decides to find the facts and the conclusion of law, will be then sent to the council for a decision, at which point the council decides, and the council suspension or revocation of an officer certification may be appealed under Title 63G, Chapter 4, Part 4 of the Judicial Review. And looking at 63G 4204, there are certain matters that have to be addressed in an order. For instance, in a formal adjudicated proceeding, there has to be a file number. There has to be a finding of facts, which in this case there was. There has to be language to indicate that the appeal is going to be going to the next level. So in this regard, I do not agree with the interpretation by the respondent's counsel in regards to the appeal board.
If I might, may just respond. In 2009, there was a case called Gannon versus Post, and in that, the Utah Court of Appeals heard a case where they found that the council had the authority to review the ALJ's factual findings and independent determinations, and whether the appellant in that case committed malfeasance. Since then, the statutes and questions have been amended to where post counsel does not have that authority to review those factual findings anymore, and I believe under that change in the law is what creates or is what makes that a final appealable order.
My understanding that changed in 2010, is that correct?
So yeah, the law did change in regards in response to that. However, there is no specific law that addresses that the council cannot address additional facts or whatnot. The argument is generated by post regarding whether or not facts have been hashed or rehashed or not. So there is no specific law as cited by the respondent's counsel that specifically indicates that the council cannot review additional facts. It's generally by post that precludes that because the facts have already been argued in front of an ALJ with the findings of facts and conclusion of law. In regards to this, if we're looking at the rule, Utah Administrative Rule R-728-409, after the council has decided the matter, the council chairperson shall issue a final order within 30 days of the council's meeting. In this case, we haven't even issued a final order. There is no order that has been issued. And so in regards to that,
I don't believe that the ALJ's decision is an appealable order at this time.
So I think what we, at a minimum, I think there's an open question as to how the law should be currently interpreted. And this is the reason that we're asking for this stay right now, so that we can get a clear interpretation on whether the ALJ's findings of facts and conclusions of law could be interpreted by or rehashed by the post-counsel, or whether they're just set. So just for the sake of clarity on the issue, I think it'd be important to stay today's proceedings.
Quick question. The ALJ's order was dated December 4th, 2018, right?
That's correct.
What was the filing on the date on the Court of Appeals case?
The Court of Appeals case was filed.
Briefing schedule been set or nothing of that nature? Because it was, and granted, administrative processes may well be handled quicker, but I think there have been cases pending at the Court of Appeals level for over a year and a half, at least in criminal matters, depending on the issue presented.
You're correct,
Counselor.
Court of Appeals, I appreciate your position. We're going to go ahead and move forward with the case.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And just for the sake of preserving the issues for the Court of Appeals, I'd just like to state on the record that we would like to challenge the ALJ's findings, the facts, and conclusions of law, and as well as challenge the constitutionality of the statute under vagueness. And with that, I'd like to turn some time over to my client to speak to the counsel, and then after that, I'd like to address the counsel.
Duly noted. Thank you. Go ahead. Mr. Hammond.
Hello, I'm Kenny Hammond. A number of years ago, I started in law enforcement, and I thought, you know, I had to be, my wife was very apprehensive, thought, what a crazy way to go and make a living. I had to agree with her on that. I started in October of 1991 for a local police department and went through a lot of upheaval in that department and was one of the few surviving members after the department was taken apart and then put back together again. I got a chance to stay in the sheriff's office and go work in the jail, and I found that the jail and corrections was really kind of a niche, something that I enjoyed, I excelled at. And I found there was a lot of things that I didn't like about the training. I felt that we needed to really professionalize our corrections officers, really make sure that when people come and are arrested in jail, they're treated humanely, they're processed properly, the arresting officers not waiting on hours on end to get in and out of the jail to do their jobs. I used to go to the in-service training, and a lot of you that have a little gray in your whiskers remember those early in-service days when you'd go to defensive tactics or arrest control tactics, and it wasn't 4 hours of training. It was kind of 4 hours of punishment. You went in and you got done at the end of the class, you were like, oh man, I'm glad that's done for a year now. So I had a chance to go become an instructor. I was very fortunate to fall under the tutelage of some tremendous men at Fred House Academy, and from early 90s and up into the early parts of 2000, right around prior to the Olympics, just right at the Olympics, I taught every in-service class that went through Fred House. I found that there was a lot of teaching and instruction with attitude. And when you were in class, if you didn't participate or represent yourself well, then the instructor sometimes would punish you with their knowledge. So I thought, you know, I needed to be a little humble when I teach. And I went through and I taught. If you have corrections officers working in your jails or working for your agencies that have come over, chances are I was one of their primary instructors. One of the things that I went about and I wanted to do in corrections was to really learn how to control people. Your corrections officers are really the unsung heroes in law enforcement. The amount of strip searches, the things they have to put up with, the day-to-day grime in a jail is excruciating. Now, I don't make any excuses for a tap to the shoulder. It's been described as a punch. It was a situation where two people who had known each other, supervisor, subordinate, but also had a friendly relationship, had worked together for some time. There was two ways of communication. There was communication back and forth. It wasn't just a one-sided deal. Also, where we were at, as witnessed and spoken to from the witness, It wasn't a hard, it wasn't a back swing hard. It was a tap to the shoulder. Now, it's startling. It was startling. It obviously startled our corrections clerk. And you know, for that, I feel really bad. I really think that there's been a lot of issue at the office, especially since I've retired. Now, to make light of whether I resigned or whether I retired, I had to get two knees replaced. I was pretty much done. It was a convenient time for me to go out. Would I have stayed at the sheriff's office and fought? Absolutely. I have a tremendous case with the sheriff's office to preserve my job as a lieutenant. I've been a lieutenant for 12 years. I've been a training coordinator from 2000 to 2014. My job was to train and make defensive tactics instructors. Fred House used to make use of my guys quite regularly when they were assigned to me, and one of the requirements always made is they were always participate down here at Post. Post has utilized the instructors that I've trained. What's lacking in my case is context. There's communication. When you're in a situation and you're in talking and you're communicating with someone, there's two ways of communication. When I was explaining things and going through things, there was communication. She was an active participant. She sat and visited. She knew me well enough. She could have said at any time, no, I don't want to do this, Lieutenant. I got to go. She didn't. We had visited back and forth. We had sat down and eaten and meals together in a communal fashion in the jail. We have a cafeteria system. Me and this person were well known to each other. The issue is, when I was talking to her, when I was face-to-face standing right by her, and I was explaining things to her, she asked, is this going to knock me out? Which I replied, no. And then I tapped her to the shoulder. And when I tapped her, the motion was no more than just my hand falling on her shoulder. Now, I'm a big guy. That goes against me. In many situations, when it's bad situations, it's gone for me. But don't let my size or a perception that I'm not a humble person or that I didn't dearly care for anybody working at the sheriff's office or anybody that I've trained. They say it was informal training. Well, you know what? How many times is there informal training? One of the things that we did at the sheriff's office is actively recruit future corrections officers out of our clerk staff. How do you recruit deputies if you don't expose them a little bit? Talk to them, visit them, maybe stimulate them, perk their interest in something, get them to want a desire to come and take the next step and attend the academy. I wasn't trying to hurt anyone. I was investigated by the sheriff's office, and it was unfounded. I was investigated by Farmington PD, and they ran the case through the Davis County Attorney's Office, and I've got a decline to prosecute. There was no intent to hurt anyone. It was an informal training, and I feel horrible that this young lady has any issues from this. But I also understand that I'm here. I'm standing before you. I'm asking for consideration. Some of you know me personally. Some of you have dealt with me. Some of you have people that I've trained in your agencies. All I ask is to take the context and put the context back in the conversation. When you have someone standing before you and they say, it's not going to knock me out, there's consent implied. It was given. There was an acknowledgement between us that you can't really explain. Did she say yes? No. She did not verbalize it. I did not hear that. I'm not going to lie. I'm not going to misrepresent facts. I did strike her in the upper part of her shoulder. But it was a benign strike, a strike that I've demonstrated literally to hundreds of people. We do often, we have mutual come in. They do tours of the jail. People like to come in and do their version of Scared Straight. They like to come in and interview an inmate or talk and see the jail. I've demonstrated this technique in self-defense classes I've taught for years and years. I've demonstrated this technique in classes I've taught for Fred House and at Post years ago. I think the funnest day in training I've ever had is when we used to do the day in a life trainings. Those were some of the best and funnest training scenarios that I've ever participated in. But my intent was not to injure or harm. It just simply was not there. I feel terrible that someone felt that I was there to hurt or injure someone, because that was not my intent. And I think that's evidenced by the decline to prosecute. I think that's evidenced by the internal affairs investigation that I went to, and I just humbly ask you to take those things in consideration. I'll be happy to answer any question that you might have.
Any questions for Mr. Hammond? Seeing none, counsel.
Okay. It's my understanding that that Mr. Hammond has been placed into a Category C for the post-council disciplinary guidelines. Under Category C, comes with a baseline 2-year suspension with a range of 9 months to 3.5 years. And one of the things that would put you in a Category C is if you engage in conduct, which is a state or federal criminal offense that is a Class B misdemeanor, and the ALJ has determined that a Class B misdemeanor did occur here, and which involves an act of violence. If we look at the code for assault, code for assault says an act committed with unlawful force or violence that causes bodily injury to another and creates a set substantial risk of bodily injury to another. Okay. So what we have here, we have an act, and it can be either unlawful force or it could be violence. The ALJ doesn't speak to this issue as to what which it is. He says there's a violation, but he doesn't say if it's an act of violence or if it's just unlawful force. So the question is, what's unlawful force? And I'm going to tell you right now, in my research of Utah law, this issue isn't well discussed. But in an adjacent jurisdiction, one court found that the common law, and this was Washington, the common law definition of assault recognized in Washington is an unlawful touching with criminal intent. At common law, a touching is unlawful when the person touched did not consent to it, and it was either harmful or offensive. So I would suggest to you that what happened is not an act of violence at all. It is a Class B misdemeanor, but it's more appropriately classified under Category E. Category E has a baseline suspension of 6 months, and it can range from a letter of caution to 1.5-year suspension. And that's just when an officer engages in conduct, which is a state or federal offense, that is a Class B misdemeanor, but does not involve sexual acts, harassment, theft, crimes of dishonesty, and the use of alcohol or misuse of prescription drugs. Really what this case turns on is consent. The ALJ found in his findings of facts on page 4 of the order, number 14 and 15, he found that immediately prior to the punch, SW knew that Hammond was going to make contact with her in demonstrating a technique. However, she was not expecting to be punched in any way. Number 15. SW was a reluctant participant in the impromptu kickboxing training and did not consent to being punched. So what the ALJ has found is there was no consent here. But I would just pose some open questions to the council. If these really make sense to you, what the ALJ is proposing is that whatever consent is offered to be touched, it has to be specific to a particular act. And so what I would question is, suppose you're in a basketball game and two players go up for a rebound and one accidentally hits the other. Did the one that get hit consent to being hit? like that, or did he consent to play basketball? If I'm walking down the hallway, one of my coworkers goes up for a high five, and he gives me an exceptionally hard high five, which causes pain and redness, is that assault? I would suggest it's not. I'd like to discuss, let's talk about violence. In the ALJ's findings of fact and conclusions of law, in his analysis, he talks about mental state. He says, in this case, there is no evidence that Hammond committed the act with the intent to cause bodily injury to SW, nor is there any evidence that he knew it would cause bodily injury. To me, that does not indicate violence. If anything, it perhaps unlawful touching under the findings of fact and conclusions of law, but there's no indication of violence here. Later in the order, the ALJ says, in conclusion, Hammond's act is not an egregious case of assault, and there's no evidence that he intended to cause harm. He did ignore a substantial risk of harm and acted recklessly and struck SW. This is more indicative of unlawful touching than it is violence. So under the post guidelines for discipline, just going back, I would first request that we put this into category E where it belongs, with a baseline suspension of 6 months. That's the first thing I'd ask for. The next thing I'd like to do is just go over some comparables of other offenses and suspensions. On now, there isn't a lot that's been before post counsel that's like this case, just because this case is so minor. Like my client pointed out, it's been reviewed and dismissed by a prosecutor. That they declined prosecution because they felt there was no crime here. But on June 22nd, 2015, Salvador Toscano came before this body with an assault. In that case, Salvador pushed his daughter's boyfriend to the ground twice, then immediately reported the incident. A 9-month suspension was recommended in that case, and a letter of caution was issued. A couple of other cases that you might find interesting. These are for disorderly conduct. They're not for assault. But on January 4th, 2016, Brad Gailey came before the body for disorderly conduct. In that case, Brad's neighbors were having a party while Brad and his family were sleeping. Brad asked them to keep the noise down. A female swore at Brad, and he knocked a cup from her hand, knocked it on the ground. In that case, a letter of caution was recommended, and a letter of caution was upheld by this body. On September 14th, 2015, Luana J. Willis was admitted to a hospital after an attempted suicide. She became verbally upset and bumped into a uniformed officer. A letter of caution was recommended and upheld in that case. The point I want to drive home in this case, there's no breach of the peace. At no point was there a breach of the peace in this assault. This was merely it was a demonstration, and that the ALJ has found that it was beyond the scope of consent. I would disagree with that, but that's what the ALJ's finding is. And so based on that, I would request that in our case, that this body, that the punishment should be a letter of caution. Pending any questions from the body, that's all I have.
Any questions? Yeah, Chief Allen. I just want to
make a motion if I can. Okay, because I think what Mr. Hammond did was certainly dumb and stupid and not very lieutenant-like, but I don't think there was any intent for assault, and it wasn't prosecuted, so I'd actually like to make a motion that we give a letter. Chairman, before the motion, can I ask a question of legal counsel?
Go ahead.
Mr. Yockey, could you tell me either if Mr. Hammond or any person that comes in before the council, when they have an administrative law judge, let's say the administrative law judge finds that there was no criminal conduct or anything, would they still come before the body? They wouldn't. So having said that, reading the statement here, exactly what the chief's on page 11, the victim in this case was a reluctant witness, and it appears from the evidence that she did not want to make a big deal of this incident. Hammond's act is not an egregious case of assault, and there is no evidence that he intended to cause harm. I find that unique that the administrative law judge puts that in, and then the very next line, he turns around and says he did ignore a substantial risk of harm, acted reckless, and it meets the statutory requirements of assault. So as a council member, why can I not disagree with what that administrative, because I don't think he met the requirements of assault. I've been a police officer for 26 years. I would have never charged him with an assault. So why does the council have to follow the ALG, Jay's recommendation?
Marcus, can I have just, and I want you to weigh in on that, but council's brought up issues of statutory construction and a lot of legal things that it sounds like they're anxious to litigate in the context of the appeal on the ALG's findings. Correct me if I'm wrong, but under the Utah assault statute, it's not my understanding that the intent goes to the outcome, i.e. whether you intend to cause injury or intend to hurt somebody. The intent goes to, did you put your hand back, pull it back, and voluntarily throw the punch? So I think that given that, the focus on whether or not he intended to hurt her is maybe a little bit misplaced. I think the other thing about this is, and this comes up all the time, but the failure to prosecute, I mean, almost every prosecutor I know, because it's mandated by the bars, it's mandated by criminal law, we, in making charging decisions, have to utilize not a clear and convincing standard, but a reasonable likelihood of success at trial paired with probable cause, which is a much higher standard than what we're dealing with here. So I think because in this case, and it is in other cases, where maybe there's been a prosecutorial declination under a much higher standard, I don't understand how that, and I'm happy to, you know, be explained and see the light, but I don't understand how a body using a different standard, how that bearing should have any precedent on what we do here.
So let me address the matters really quick as far as the request for advice. I do agree with Victoria's analysis on the assault in regards to the specific intent to actually cause harm versus the assault. In regards to your question, Sheriff, the matter, so when it comes to an ALJ hearing, the post has evidence that's being presented. They have witnesses that are being presented. And so that's why the ALJ and the sanction is separated, right? So we're having, unless you guys wanted to have all the hearing before you, which I'm not sure how long this hearing occurred, but it's usually six to an eight hour hearing with all the matters. I know some hearings have gone 2 days. So in light of that, that's why there is a separate system as far as having the findings of facts and conclusion of law, and then having the council decide on the sanctions after the ALJ has decided the matter. Again, as I stated before, there's nothing that precludes you from you as a council member from deciding facts that are different from the ALJ. It's just this has gone before the ALJ with evidence, with witnesses, with all these other things. So in light of that, that's where we're at. So hopefully that makes sense.
So currently we have a motion on the floor from Chief Swanson. We have a second. Do you want to clarify what your motion is?
My motion is for a letter to counsel. And when I speak of intent, I don't mean intent to have caution. I mean, it was intent to harm. I don't think there was any intent for an assault. It was stupid training idea.
So we have a motion for a letter of...
Chairman, may I
address the council before the motions are heard?
Go ahead.
Yeah, if I may. I'd just like to read some of the facts into the record.
Okay.
So I'll be reading from the ALJ's opinion, finding the fact.
Starting on page 2 of the administrative law judge's findings. So the administrative law judge, of course, heard all of the witnesses in this case, including the eyewitness, the nurse, who was a reluctant witness earlier, but ultimately was not a reluctant witness, finally, at the ALJ hearing. He heard from the investigators. He heard from the from Mr. Hammond. He heard from the victim, a variety of witnesses. He heard all of the evidence, saw photographs, considered all the evidence, and then issued his findings of fact. And some of the findings of fact are as follows. The victim in this case is a civilian employee of the jail and has no defensive tactics training requirements. The kickboxing techniques and moves being demonstrated by Hammond were not job-related, were not official training of any sort. SW, the victim, did not request that Hammond provide her with defensive tactics training, kickboxing training, or physical training of any kind. Hammond is approximately 6'2" in height and weighs over 300 pounds. SW is approximately 5'6" in height and weighs approximately 130 pounds. At some point during the encounter, Hammond demonstrated at least two punches which came near to SW's face and may have touched the tip of her nose. Although she was uncomfortable with the closeness of the punches, SW did not believe that Hammond, whom she held in high regard as a supervisor, would actually hit her. Hammond asked SW if she had any medical condition, and she replied, yes. SW has a vagus nerve stimulator implanted near her left collarbone area. But Hammond did not ask what the condition was or otherwise follow up on that response. He then put his hand on this 130-pound woman's shoulder and began to show her a specific He then put his hand on SW's shoulder to begin to show her a specific move or technique. Believing he may be going to press on her carotid artery, SW asked him if she was going to faint or be knocked out by the move, and he replied, no. The move or technique demonstrated by Hammond was a hand-to-knuckles closed fist punch. Hammond placed the tips of his finger on her SW's right shoulder and then, in one motion, closed his fingers into a fist and struck SW's shoulder from a short distance. The strike knocked her back slightly, caused her to cough, expel mucus from one nostril, give her a headache, and cause a red mark on her shoulder. Immediately prior to delivering the punch, Hammond distracted SW by asking how she wrings out a rag and demonstrating how it should be done. I think that those facts are important to consider when the council is making its decision.
Thanks, Ms. Beattie. Any questions?
Yes, sir.
One question on page 4.14, where it says that SW knew Hammond was going to make contact. What kind of contact was she expecting?
Let's see. SW knew Hammond was going to make contact with her in demonstrating the technique. However, she was not expecting to be punched in any way. Apparently, she thought he was going to press on her carotid, which is what it says in the previous paragraph, or previous, somewhere in here, I just read it. He thought she was going to press on her shoulder. He was going to press on her shoulder. And may I just make one other point? I'm sorry, sir, that he was...
I don't even have it read to me again.
Right, and I won't read it again, but I want to make one point, that he was her supervisor. And I think that's also an extremely important fact that needs to be considered here. And that's also a factor that should be considered in whether or not she was reluctant or not reluctant to come forward with these allegations.
Thank you. Any further questions? Mr. Hammond.
Can I just add one thing?
Briefly.
You know, it's, like I said, it's all in context. When you're talking with someone, you're communicating with someone face-to-face, they're right there, and you're explaining something, and you do touch them, and you do this maneuver right here. That's it. That's the extent of it. There was no force behind it. It's startling. It startles you. But I had no desire to hurt this young lady. We had an excellent working relationship. She was one of my clerks, and I really feel very, very unfortunate about how all this has come out, especially with her. She's been blamed for my retiring. Or, you know, in reality, I was going to retire anyway. I had to get my knees replaced. I was done. And am I going to go back in law enforcement? I doubt it. I bought a nice farm. I'm prepared to move on. I'm ready to move on to a new chapter of my life. But I don't feel that this should hang over my head when things aren't taken in context. They're taken out of context. And, you know, I just ask that that be taken in consideration.
Thank you. We have a motion.
We have a second. We have a motion from Chief Swanson for a letter of caution. Do we have a second?
Second.
We have a second from Sheriff Pulsifer. Do we have any further discussion? Seeing none, I'll call for the vote. Those in favor?
Aye. Aye.
Any opposed? We show Victoria McFarland opposed. Any others? John Crowley opposed as well. Any others? Thank you.
Thank you. I appreciate it.
Next.
Is Stephen Harlow or his counsel present? Stephen? Ms. Feedy?
Stephen Harlow, who was a police officer with the Blanding PD, the sustained charge was lying under Garrity. Correct? These are both sustained? Okay. And engaging in sexual conduct while on duty. Post recommends revocation. Sorry. Stephen Harlow has 4 years of service. He was terminated by the Blanding Police Department. The aggravating factor is that there are multiple offenses. The date of separation was August 24th, 2017. The baseline is revocation, 3 years suspension, and POST is recommending revocation. On or about January 27th, 2017, Stephen Harlow was investigated by his agency for allegations regarding an inappropriate relationship between him and a 17-year-old nanny he had hired to care for his children. After being given a Garrity warning, Harlow denied having any relationship with the nanny beyond conversations and denied any physical relationship with the nanny whatsoever. On or about August 14th, 2017, an additional administrative investigation was initiated after Harlow's police chief received citizen complaints about an inappropriate relationship between Harlow and the nanny. The investigation was handled by an outside law enforcement agency. During the investigation and while under Garrity, Harlow admitted he had kissed his nanny many times beginning in September 2016. The administrative investigation also determined Harlow had sexual intercourse with his wife while on duty at the police department on more than one occasion. The investigation also determined Harlow grabbed the breast of a female ride-along in the patrol vehicle on at least one occasion. Harlow declined to participate in the post-investigation. You, Mr. Harlow? Okay. Would you like to address the council?
Ladies and gentlemen of the council, thank you for being here. I know that whether my case was pending before you or not, you would still be in these seats. However, right now you are here to determine sanctions on my actions, and so for that I thank you. I also apologize that we need to be in these seats taking care of this today. This is a very interesting case. I've done some research on similar cases that this council has heard over the last couple of years, and can honestly say that I feel this varies quite a bit from some of those other situations. Before I get into the allegations, I'd like to give you a little bit of my background as a time with as an officer. I'm one of those that always dreamed of being a police officer from the time that I was a kid. When I was a young teen, I was diagnosed with asthma, and I saw my dreams of becoming a police officer go out the window. Didn't feel I'd be able to make it through post with the physical standard requirements. After getting married and having our first child, I spoke with medical professionals again, and the doctor said he would have no problem signing a medical release form for me to enter the academy. And so I took it upon myself to make contact with Chief Flowers down at the Dixie State Academy, made contact with him a full year before the academy class that I would be joining would open. I had my paperwork done within a couple of weeks. Despite the amount of time I had, I was eager. I was ready to go. During the academy, throughout my law enforcement career, I've learned quite a number of people are familiar with Bob Flowers. You know his reputation. You know he runs a good, tight ship. During the academy, I believe we started with 33 recruits. Only 19, I believe, ended up graduating. Among those 19, I was fourth in the class in testing. I was tied for first in firearms and among the tops in the physical requirements despite the asthma. I put myself through the academy. I did not wait for a sponsor. I sponsored myself because I felt it would give me an edge in trying to get employment to show my drive and my determination. And after graduating the academy, it was nearly 7 months before I obtained employment utilizing my LEO certification. Originally, actually, it was only my SFO certification. My first job, I was a bailiff in the Salt Lake City Justice Court. At the time, it was under the Wasatch Constable's Office that I was sworn through. After just over a year and a half there, I obtained my employment with Blanding City. During my time with Blanding City, I was given many tasks to undertake, even as the rookie of the group. I became the fleet manager for our fleet of vehicles. During my time as fleet manager, I was able to get additional items installed on our vehicles, additional safety and visibility while saving the department and the city money. During my time there, I served as an animal control officer. The previous officer before me had a 90% euthanization rate for animals that came in and an 82% recidivism rate for bringing in that 10% of animals that did go back. 82% of them ended up coming back again. During my time with animal control, that euthanization rate dropped to 10%, and the recidivism rate was below 5%. Every task that I was given, I dove straight in, sometimes at the behest of my now ex-wife. I put in a lot of hours, did everything I could to be the best officer that I could. My first number of my first two jury trials that I had before I even had a bench trial, I prevailed. Each of my bench trials, I prevailed. During the point in time in which these original allegations came to pass, I was actually awarded the 2016 Officer of the Year Award by the city because these things were being investigated, and being a small rural town, all the neighbors knew where I lived. Everybody in the town knew where I lived, knew where I parked my car. The city felt that instead of presenting this to me in any normal fashion, a banquet dinner at city council, it was left on my desk in my office for me to receive that way. And yet, they felt that despite these things, I was their Officer of the Year in 2016. When it comes to these allegations, you'll see that there was no ALJ hearing. With these two items, I informed the post investigators. I had already admitted to these things. There was no purpose in having that hearing. The only thing that I would have argued was that in the having sexual contact on duty, this states that it was said that happened three times. I would only argue that it was once, but once is enough to merit this allegation. Therefore, I didn't feel there was much point in doing that, but that it may play a mitigating factor in your decisions. Addressing those items themselves, I will first address the the minor of the two, the sexual conduct while on duty. In many of the cases that I read before this council, a lot of these situations were a matter of officers having sex while on duty in their patrol car, in a public place, with somebody other than their spouse, or someone that they were not currently married to in any way, shape, or form. This was with my wife. 3 months into my three-year time at Blanding City, she was on a ride-along with me. It was late night. We went to the office behind closed doors in my office and engaged in the sexual conduct. And again, it's not an excuse. I did it. However, this was 3 months into a three-year term. Never gets brought up until after I have served her with divorce papers, kicked her out of the house, and the investigation was going on. When I had the interview with Utah County Sheriff's Office, they did not present this to me as, hey, this is what your wife said. They presented it as, your wife brought up other things. Do you know what they might be? And I told them about this. So in many ways, it was a self-report, as it was not presented to me through the investigation. When it comes to the lying under Garrity, when I had my interview with the police chief of Blanding City, I signed the paper stating that I had a full understanding of what Garrity meant when I shouldn't have. It was my understanding that anything said in the Garrity interview could not be used in a criminal case, which I was afraid might happen. But I couldn't see why it couldn't be used to necessarily open a criminal case. Couldn't be used against me in one, but possibly could be used to open one. And so I was not fully honest with the chief in that interview. When Utah County did their second interview, it was explained to me, hey, if you kissed the nanny and she was 17, it's not right, it's unethical, but it's not criminal. He said he could not think of anybody that if that's all it was a kiss, would ever charge anything criminally for any type of sexual conduct with a minor. And so at that time, I told the truth. I was faced with a lose-lose situation. I could either continue to lie and hope that it wouldn't be discovered and risk losing my certification if it was, or I could now tell the truth, admitting I lied under Garrity once before, and risk the revocation of my certification. I chose to take that higher ground and try to save as much face, reputation, as I possibly could. You will notice that neither of these allegations have anything to do with what I was being investigated for while under Garrity. There was nothing ever found, because there was nothing to be found in regards to illegal behavior by the Blanding City Police Department. There was nothing found illegal behavior by the Utah County investigation. And so in many ways, I made the mistake of lying about something that here in the end didn't even matter. There was nothing found that needed to be lied about. Ladies and gentlemen of the council, again, I appreciate you taking the time to listen to me. I want you to know that whether you allow me to continue as a police officer in the future, I bleed blue. It's a punch in my gut every time I see a traffic stop. Anytime I'm driving down the road and I see a crime scene going on, I see an officer performing a felony stop alone,
and I can't back him up. It's a punch to the gut every time my children ask me why I'm not a cop anymore. And I don't give them the full details. They're too young to know that. But I tell them, Dad, he made a mistake. And they ask me if I'll ever be a cop again. And I tell them, I don't know. But that I hope so. I've personally known a number of officers that have been disciplined by this council, one of which got a job with Blanding City while I was working there. He was disciplined for a similar act of sexual conduct on duty. I was taught at the academy by Jason Adams, who was also disciplined by this council. I simply ask that based on these two allegations, because of their lack of, well, in the case of the sexual conduct on duty, the lack of severity, I think, honestly, we kid ourselves if we say there are no police officers that ever have sex on duty with their wives. We just don't hear about it unless it's something like this. And that when it comes to the lying under Garrity, I wasn't presented with something and then continued to lie about it. I chose the road to become honest the second time around. And with that being said, I would ask that you move away from post recommendation of a revocation. Anything less would make my life.
Thank you. Thanks, Mr. Harlow. Any questions? Seeing none, call for the motion.
I'll make a motion. We go with the revocation.
Second.
Okay, I have a motion from Sheriff Noel and I had a second from Mike Hatton. Those in favor?
Aye.
Any opposed? Seeing none, passes. I think we'll have to take a five-minute. Oh, we need a motion to take a five-minute break. So move. Thank you. I'd like to call post council to order. Ms. Vitti, we'll go ahead with Schwen Heimberg.
Okay, the next case is Schwen Heimberg, and Mr. Heimberg is here, and he is represented by his counsel, Phil Dyer, and maybe Ben Dyer too. Sorry. Schwen Heimberg is an officer with the South Salt Lake Police Department. The sustained charge was a BCI violation, a Category E offense. Post's recommendation is a 15-month suspension, and the baseline is a 6-month suspension. I apologize. There is an aggravating factor, and the aggravating factor is that there were multiple offenses. So there were 4 separate violations sustained. In the criminal matter, he pled no contest to a B misdemeanor. On October 30th, 2012, South Salt Lake Police Department investigated Schwen Heimberg for accessing BCI division records for a non-law enforcement purpose. An internal investigation was conducted and concluded Heimberg had accessed the driver license records of at least 4 police dispatchers, Valley Emergency Communications Dispatchers. Garrity interviews were conducted by South Salt Lake Police Department and Post, during which Heimberg admitted to accessing 3 of the dispatchers' driver's license records. On November 5, 2013, Heimberg appeared in court regarding the 4th record and pleaded no contest to a criminal charge of unlawfully accessing BCI division records, a Class B misdemeanor, which was amended to a Class C misdemeanor. On August 28, 2018, and September 21st, 2018, a hearing was held before the administrative law judge. The ALJ subsequently issued findings of fact and conclusions of law stating Officer Heimberg violated Utah Code 536211D, as outlined in the Notice of Agency Action.
Good morning. My name is Phil Dyer. I'm here with Officer Heimberg. And we'd like to provide a few clarifications for you about this and then talk about the sanction issue. First, you're probably wondering why this happened in 2011 and 12, why we're now here in 2019. And I can explain that for you because I think you need to know.
Please.
Mr. Heimberg has been subject to five different proceedings. One was the first one was the disciplinary action in which South Salt Lake attempted to terminate his employment. They did not succeed based on the fact that there was only grounds to do a two-day suspension. During that time, however, he was on paid administrative leave and did not perform any law enforcement activities for a period of 78 days. Apparently not being satisfied with that, South Salt Lake then pursued criminal charges against Officer Heimberg in West Valley City. That case was handled by another person in my office. You may know him, Kent Morgan. And Mr. Morgan was able to negotiate a plea bargain in which he pled no contest to a Class C misdemeanor attempt to access BCI. Now, we'll stop right there for just a minute. So that's the second one. And with Post, we've had three. We've had this agency action. And then in order to obtain the comparable information, as you know, discovery is not permitted in these processes. So we had to go through Grandma to find comparables. That process took us not only through the Government Records Committee the first time, but also to district court, where after 2 years of litigation, we were then finally agreed to by former counsel, not current counsel for the post counsel, that we would have access to those records under a protective order. They would only be used for the purposes of this particular proceeding. It took, unfortunately, those records became available in the spring of 2017, and we reviewed those. After reviewing those, we were promised we'd get copies. Unfortunately, this case went dormant for a year before those documents were provided in the spring of 2018. And because of the fact there had been proceedings that had happened in between and other sanctions, we asked the Post update those sanction proceedings. They declined. As a result, we now went through number five, another grandma proceeding, in which we wound up going to the Government Records Committee. And just before that occurred, counsel graciously agreed we could have the additional records under the protective order in district court. That is what leaves us here today. I hope that addresses your question, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, counsel.
And so, but I do want to provide just a little bit of background that I think helps understand this case a little bit more. In May of 2011, there was a change to the statute regarding what constitutes a Class B misdemeanor. It went from misuse of a criminal record history to knowingly or intentionally accessing, using, disclose, or disseminating a record created, maintained, or to which access is granted by the division or in violation of a policy. And that violation of a policy is critical because there are no BCI policies on this issue. There are only South Salt Lake policies. And in August of 2011, when some of these activities happened, Officer Heimberg, and this was Heimberg Exhibit Number 1, I have duplicate copies if you would like, took a test and did an operator signed an operating testing agreement 2011 that's on official state BCI letterhead. So as of August of 2011, the most important thing is page 2 of that says that a criminal misuse of access to criminal history record information is a Class B misdemeanor. It did not have the current statute. And so there had been no policy adopted by South Salt Lake regarding the change in the statute. That happened in July of 2012, when BCI sent out an email to everyone at that point in time and said, oh, there was a change in the statute in May of 2011, by the way, and now we're not going to permit, quote, curiosity checks of any kind, running your friends, family, neighbors, celebrities, et cetera, and will become Class B misdemeanors. And it was at that point in time that there was a time when Mr. Heimberg accessed not a driver's license record, but a photograph. If you look through paragraphs 9, 10, 11, and 12, you will see that he did not access any data. He couldn't tell you the height, where they were born, anything that's on a driver's license, he couldn't tell you. All he saw was a picture. And in fact, the one in September of 2012, he didn't see the picture because he misspelled her name. And so as a result, he was interviewed three times, not once, not twice, three times, by South Salt Lake, during which was then Lieutenant Ruth, now Chief Deputy Ruth, acknowledged that he didn't know that this had changed in the statute as this was occurring and learned about it as a result of this investigation. And so as a result, what happened then was they decided to give him a two-day suspension. After the two-day suspension, the criminal matter was then dismissed on June 2, 2014, the agency filed its administrative action. Now, I will tell you there was an investigation done by Post. He was interviewed by Post. And that investigation was not used in any shape, fashion, or form as part of this ALJ proceeding. The proceedings were based solely and exclusively on what was done by South Salt Lake. Now, did he look at the pictures? Yes, I think he admitted that. And in fact, in the decision, what did the ALJ say he did? He says, I was putting a face to the voice. Is there any evidence of any sort of stalking, harassing, doing anything to these individuals? No. No, what we have here is what I would call clean violations. And the reason I say that is because we spent a considerable amount of time and effort going through Post records through the grandma process, and we have a comprehensive list of past decisions issued by this council. And I can summarize those for you, and I'd like to pass those out so that they become a part of the record. There have been, whenever there is less than five BCI violations, there have been 9 letters of caution. Whenever there has been other misconduct coupled with the BCI violations, there have been 3 3-month suspensions. And then when there have been prior sanctions involved in anything over 10 violations, there have been 2 6-month suspensions. So as a result, as we sit here today, we don't believe that Officer Heinberg falls in D. We believe he falls in E, because he did plead to a Class C misdemeanor and paid a $300 fine. And most importantly, it wasn't mentioned by counsel, that charge has now been expunged for good cause finding by the judge. So as he stands here today, he can testify lawfully and under the statute that, in fact, he has not committed any crime. So based on that, we would contend that I do have these, and I would like to pass those out and make them part of the record.
May I respond to that?
Just one moment.
So what are we attempting to introduce, just for clarification?
The chart that you had been sent you by my co-counsel.
Which chart?
The chart of comparables.
Just the comparables?
Just comparables, not Officer Heinberg.
Just one second.
Objection, and then we'll go ahead and circle back, Ms. Beattie.
May I respond to the objection?
Yeah, after, yes.
Okay. You mean after I conclude?
She was.
Okay, ready. Go ahead. I'm sorry.
I don't believe it's permitted by the rules. The rules permit the council. I'm sorry. I think we had this issue before of written documents being provided to counsel, and I believe the rules, and I'll read them here, only permit written or provide for written materials being provided by the officer's employer, and it permits counsel to address and the officer to address the counsel, but there's no provision in the rules for them to provide written materials to the counsel. That would be my objection.
Thank you, Counsel.
Mr. Chairman, my response would be, we tried to offer these to the ALJ. He declined. In fact, he issued a specific order on August 28th in which he said the following at paragraph 6. Heinberg asserts he needs to have access to the requested information for purposes of including it on the record, since he contends that the record created at the evidentiary hearing is the only record in this case. This is clearly not correct. If Heinberg is agreed by the results of the post-disciplinary process, then he can file an appeal. In that case, the decision findings of the sanctioning body will also be a part of the record. If those findings are deficient and call into question, then the sanctions will be differently imposed. And all I'm doing is providing what a summary of what we were able to find through those 2 grandma processes that show disparity in sanctions between the ones that are just involved BCI, those that involve BCI plus other conduct, and those that involve BCI with multiple violations over 10, and we're saying none of those apply. This is just a letter of caution case. This is not information, because we tried to present this. I mean, and I pointed him out to a case that I actually handled before this body called Benson versus Department of Corrections, which I got dinged by the Court of Appeals for not including something in the record. And so I've made it my point to try to make sure this stuff is included in the record. So we would like to have the council consider, consider these documents. May we pass them out?
Yes.
While those are going around, if I may, Mr. Chairman, I'd go ahead and make a couple other points. You will see on the first page there are four individuals identified. Number two, and I'm doing this to protect their privacy rights. That was the reason to do this and not identify all of these individuals. We could do that. I could read through this and do that, but I don't think that's the way to go. But just to use this as an example, number two, number three, and number four on this first page are all individuals that were employed with South Salt Lake City Police Department in 2012. And you can see there, in number four, there were six BCI violations, and that was used for purposes of entertainment. And that individual received a letter of caution. And so one of the concerns that we have in looking at this, the guidelines you have for sanctions, is that when they are close in time, then it's supposed to be concurrent. But also we have an issue about, if you will, as to whether or not the policy was even in place. There was no policy in place by South Salt Lake Police Department until July of 2012. And three of these charges occurred before that time period. So our contention is those violations are not a violation of the law. And, in fact, he wasn't charged with those violations. And Deputy Chief Roof testified that he did not get any information beyond a picture. In other words, he said he attempted to get information, but he didn't get it. And so what I'm suggesting to you is that this is a case that, for whatever reason I can't understand or explain, has taken on, it's gone from a molehill to the Rocky Mountain Range, and I don't understand it. And they're asking for a 15-month suspension. And I went and did the research on Post's website. Since 2011, there have only been two cases that have warranted a 15-month suspension. They did not involve BCI. I don't know how this case gets to be a 15-month suspension. Frankly, I don't know how it gets to be a suspension at all. Given the comparables that we provided you with, there are no other conduct that's been involved, and this should simply be a letter of caution. And with that, I'm going to turn over time and let Mr. Heinberg speak to you. Oh, you got a question. I'm sorry.
Which office handled the criminal prosecution?
Which office?
Which prosecutorial entity?
West Valley City.
And what was the approximate date of filing, and how long was that pending?
It was pending for approximately 9 months. The plea bargain was done in January of 2014.
Justice or district court?
Justice. It was done in 2000. The plea bargain, reducing it to an attempted BCI violation, was a Class C misdemeanor, was done in January of 2014. And in June, it was dismissed, and then in October, it was expunged.
I'll probably need to recuse.
I'm sorry?
For the record, Ms. McFarland will recuse herself. She was involved in that case. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you. I appreciate that.
Dr. Levitt? Excuse me. Dr. Budd will also recuse himself.
Okay.
Thank you.
Mr. Chairman, I have some...
Ms. Beattie, can you please take the...
Oh, sorry. Would you like to hear, may I respond right now, or would you like me to wait until...
Let's have Mr. Heinberg first, and then we'll have you summarize. Thank you.
With that, I'll turn the time over to Officer Heinberg.
Thank you.
Thank you for the opportunity to address the council. Some 34 years ago, I had my first encounter with the Post Agency when I originally became certified. In 2005, I retired following a successful 20 and one-half years at adult probation and parole. precisely 13 years ago today, I was hired by the South Salt Lake Police Department. Until this case surfaced now 6 to 7 years ago, I have had no further interaction with Post. At the outset in late 2012, my agency, as Mr. Dyer mentioned, opted to pursue terminating my employment. After mounting a valid and successful defense, I was instead handed a 2-day suspension, also as Mr. Dyer mentioned, a sanction which, pursuant to existing statute, is not contestable. Unfortunately, in my humble opinion, this evolution of events has since positioned me dead center of my administration's radar screen. Naturally, any hope of advancement ever has been quashed, and even the ability to act in a field training officer capacity, especially during this time of police recruit shortages, has been eliminated in preference of assigning 2-year veteran officers to the task. I have learned a hugely valuable lesson from my conduct, and from the beginning, I have accepted complete and full responsibility for my actions. I recognize the Post Council's interest as it relates to imposing punishment, and I would hope some semblance of rehabilitative aspect factors in as well. That said, I can assure you that if 6 years of many sleepless nights and a mountain of legal fees haven't taught me a lesson, I'm not certain what will. If we're to believe the ALJ's version of events as carved in stone, and Post staff's recommendation for a 15-month suspension of my certification, my confusion is almost endless. On the other hand, I do not by any stretch of the imagination wish to downplay the gravity of my actions. What I can assure the council of is that never was there nefarious intent, nor did dissemination in any form occur. In summary, it is on this day I fall on the proverbial sword and plead with the council for perhaps a creative solution which is equally as multifaceted as this case. If suspension is simply unavoidable, I respectfully ask for some blend of clemency which retains any suspension at a minimum, all good things considered, and which takes into account the 2-day suspension I received and the 76 days I was placed on administrative leave without any peace officer certification while my agency attempted to find ways to terminate my employment in 2012-2013. With that, I humbly thank you for your time.
Are there any other questions?
No.
Okay, thank you.
Ms. Feedy?
I would just like to address the chart of the comparables that Mr. Dyer provided to council. So if everyone reviews the summary of facts and aggravating mitigating factors, you'll see that for the most part, the facts involve individuals, officers running family members' names, usually for insurance or some other innocuous reason. Except for Eric Jensen, who I think many of you remember that case. He made up a fictitious undercover name and ran that repeatedly because he thought it was funny. And I see that Anita Bench is there. She also was running that same fictitious, funny undercover name. However, there's one case that's different than the others, and that's the Larry Carver case. In the Larry Carver case, Larry Carver was a cadet. I'm on the second to last page, I think. Yeah, second to last page at the bottom of the page. Larry Carver was running the names of female cadets. The charge that was sustained was that he ran personal information, including addresses of 2 female cadets who he was interested in dating while off duty. And I would say that all of the cases here in this chart, this case is most like the Larry Carver case. Officer Heimberg ran the names of these female dispatchers after speaking to them on the radio to look at their photographs. So we have actual victims in this case. They weren't family members whose names were being checked for insurance data. They were innocent parties whose driver's licenses were being pulled up by an individual who was interested in seeing what they looked like. And I think that really goes to the heart of what this statute is all about, what the statute's supposed to protect. And that's all I have.
Any questions for Ms. Beattie? Thank you.
Can I briefly respond?
Please.
I'll be brief. During the hearing, the person that, if you will, started this process, REM, I'll use her initials, the one in September of 2012, did not want to file a complaint. She just wanted management at South Salt Lake Police Department to know about the circumstance. And she said she felt uncomfortable because she did not perceive herself as a victim. None of these individuals were ever victimized in any fashion, shape, or whatever. This is simply looking at a photograph. None of the data was obtained. Nobody was stalked. Nobody was harassed. Nothing ever happened. He just put, and in fact, at page 6, that's what the ALJ said. He was putting a face to the name. That's it. No more.
Was anyone contacted? Were any of these individuals contacted?
What do you mean? By Officer Hubbard? No.
Oh, okay, thank you. Any questions?
Oh, one other thing. Of all the comparables, he didn't disseminate any of the information. He just looked at the picture. And that makes it all completely, if you will, less egregious than any of the other violations that are here. The other information was used for personal purposes and disseminated.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
Do we have a motion? Any further discussion or questions?
I recuse myself too, just because I'm very good friends with South Salt Lake administration. I think I'll say this.
Chief Swanson has also recused himself on this, based on his relationship with Chief Kruth.
A motion from Kristen Warren?
My motion would be to go with the baseline for Category E, 6-month suspension.
So we have a motion for a 6-month Category E.
We have a second.
I'll second that.
Second from John Crowley. Any further discussion? Seeing none, I'll call for the vote. Those in favor?
Aye.
Those opposed? Seeing none, thank you.
May I please, one of the things that in terms of, I assume he'll be given credit for the 78 days?
We probably need to clarify the law enforcement. Were you suspended during that time with zero law enforcement authority?
That's what I was.
Please come up to the.
And additionally, and I spoke with counsel about this, we sent both counsel, Mr. Yockey and Ms. Vitti, this morning, a proposed motion to stay the proceedings in contemplation this case may be appealed. And part of the difficulty is in preparing that motion, I have a formal motion to file because it needs to be part of the record, is that there are no rules and post rules governing what terms or grounds are required for a stay. The problem is UAPA, Administrative Procedures Act, requires us to first file a motion for a stay here before we can go to the Court of Appeals and ask for a stay. So if you would like, I can provide the motion so it is part of the record, but we would ask the tribunal to stay the imposition of the final order until all appeals have been completed.
Just let me confer with Mr. Yockey.
You're Julie, right? Okay.
We just request that it goes before the Court of Appeals.
Okay, can I at least make my motion so that the Court of Appeals knows I've made the motion?
For the record, yes.
Okay. Should I just hand that to you? Who should I hand
Please,
it to?
Ms. Beattie on the end, if you'd like.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you. So we will treat that as a denial of our motion for a stay.
Thank you.
Very good. Thank you. Oh, that's mine. Mr. Chairman, you also didn't clarify as to whether or not he would be given credit for it.
Oh, yeah, we're still we had, how many days was that again?
78,
and you had no police authority during that time, is that correct?
That is correct. I did not.
Do you have anything in writing from your agency outlining what the requirements, what your preclusions were, I guess, if you will?
Say that again.
Do you have a letter from the South Salt Lake Police Department outlining those findings?
I can provide and supplement to you a notice of administrative suspension, and then the 2-day sanction that he was received when he went back on.
We will, and then we'll take that into consideration.
Okay. I will submit those to the council. I'll submit them through Ms. Vitti, if that's okay.
That's
and
great.
Mr. Yockey as well.
Thank you.
Thank
Appreciate
you.
It. Ms. Vitti?
Three cases left. London Palaman. Is London Palaman here? Londo Palaman.
See anyone rising?
Londo Palaman was a the charges sustained against London Palaman were willfully falsifies any information to obtain certification, category C, and lying under Garrity, a category A. Post recommends revocation. The aggravating factors are that there are multiple offenses. There are no mitigating factors. He is not currently employed and has no years of service. On June 19, 2018, Londo Palaman was investigated by Post for willfully falsifying any information to obtain certification. The Post investigation disclosed that on or about July 29, 2014 and May 22, 2018, Palaman submitted Post applications in which he listed his last date of methamphetamine use as July 22, 2009. In a pre-employment polygraph interview, Palaman admitted he had used methamphetamine at his sister's house in 2010. During a Garrity interview with Post, Palaman denied using methamphetamine in 2010 and stated the polygraph examiner had lied in his report. Palaman also claimed the polygraph examiner lied when he reported Palaman admitted to going to work impaired on methamphetamine. Post investigators reviewed the video from the polygraph examination, determined Palaman had in fact admitted to using methamphetamine in 2010 at his sister's house and admitted to going to work impaired on methamphetamine. On October 18, 2018, Londo Palaman failed to respond to the notice of agency action, and an order of default was signed by the ALJ.
Any questions for Ms. Beattie? Motion? We have a motion from Chief Swanson to accept the recommendation of Post. Second from Dr. Budd. Any discussion?
Was he already, did he go through Post already?
He was a self-sponsored, Sergeant Dave Barnett.
Go ahead.
Investigator. He was self-sponsored, put himself through an academy, but was never hired by an agency.
Further questions? We have a motion and a second. Any discussion? No further discussion. All those in favor?
Aye.
Any opposed? Seeing none, it passes. Thank you. Next.
Morgan Swenson.
Morgan Swenson or your counsel, are you here? I see no one rising.
Oh, right. This is the case I was talking about. So I guess I could ask for it, that this consideration should be given into going into closed session on this case.
Just for clarification, the motion needs to be read in, and then any discussion for the post council would need to be done in a closed session. And the parties, which in this case would be Post and any other media members, would need to be excused.
So we'll go ahead and have
a motion.
Motion.
The allegation would need to be read in first, and then
so discussion. You go ahead with the allegation, and then we'll.
So the allegation in this case is fitness for duty.
Say that again.
Are there any other facts or anything that you'd like to
present? I'll just say that this is the sustained finding is fitness for duty. The post recommendation is indefinite suspension,
and the individual has been terminated from his agency. And I would propose, or I would request, that the remaining facts be heard in closed session.
We have a motion to go into closed session. So moved. Colonel Rattledge in a second.
Second
from Spencer Austin. Go ahead and ask anyone other than host counsel. Those in favor?
Aye.
For the record, we have called the post counsel back to order. Ms. Beattie.
Technical point, a meeting may only be closed for reasons listed in Utah Code 52.4-202, including a discussion of an individual's character, professional competence, physical or mental health. And I believe for those reasons you need to have an affidavit signed.
That has been signed.
And that's done? Okay, yep. Just wanted to make sure. So where are we? Did you vote? Are we moving on to the next case?
No, we actually need a motion.
Okay.
Dr. Checkitz.
So I would like to make a motion that you require the assessment, a fitness for duty assessment from a licensed psychiatrist or a licensed advanced practice registered nurse, or sometimes known as a nurse practitioner, before we review this case again, and that we also leave that initial review and determination to the post director.
We have a second. From Chief Swanson. Any further discussion?
Yeah. So for clarification, an advanced practice registered nurse is the license, and a psychiatric nurse practitioner is sort of the informal designation, but it's someone with training in psychiatric nurse practitioner.
And for clarification, is the motion to include the post recommendation for an indefinite suspension?
Yes.
With an amendment to include post recommendation for indefinite suspension. Second by Chief Swanson. Any further discussion? Seeing none, we'll call for the vote. Those in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Any opposed? Seeing none, we'll move on.
Ms. Beattie? Oh, go ahead. Sorry. Jacqueline Moore, post investigation. Is his indefinite starting today?
Once the final order is signed?
Yes. Okay.
And the answer was yes. Sorry.
Yes, sorry.
Yes.
Ms. Beattie.
Last case?
Yes.
Well, if I could say real quick, this is very relevant. Is there a waiting period? So if you're out of the profession for 18 months, then you have to reactivate. So more time.
Our next is Rebecca Williams. Is Rebecca here or her counsel? I see no one rising. Counsel?
Okay. Rebecca Williams was a dispatcher with Valley Emergency Communication Center. The sustained charge was driving under the influence of alcohol, drugs, or a combination of both, a Category D offense. Post recommends an 18-month suspension. The baseline is a one-year suspension. The aggravating factor is that there was a traffic accident. The mitigating factor is that she self-reported. She had been employed by VEC for less than 1 year. In the criminal matter, she pled guilty to impaired driving, a Class B misdemeanor, and resigned from her agency. On February 19, 2018, Rebecca Williams was involved in a traffic accident where she struck the rear of another vehicle. The investigating officer determined Williams had taken a prescription medication earlier in the day, which affected her ability to safely operate a motor vehicle. Williams was arrested for driving under the influence of alcohol, drugs, or a combination of both, as provided in Utah Code Annotated Section 41-6A-502, a Class B misdemeanor. On May 4, 2018, Williams pled guilty to an amended charge of impaired driving as provided in Utah Code Annotated Section 41-6A-502.5, a Class B misdemeanor. Williams resigned from her employment with VEC on March 31, 2018. During a Garrity interview with Post, Williams admitted she took more than the prescribed dosage of her prescription medication and was driving a vehicle when she was involved in a traffic accident. She waived her right to a hearing and stipulated to the facts contained in the notice of agency action.
Any questions for Ms. Beattie? Seeing none, call for a motion.
A motion to accept the recommended.
Motion to accept, Christian Warren. Second.
Second.
Chad Silk. All those in favor?
Aye.
Any opposed? Seeing none.
That was the last case.
Marcus Shockey wants to take a moment and address the council. Thanks, Ms. Beattie.
So I understand I'm not on the agenda, so this is not a notable thing. It's just we do have new council members, and we have some issues that were brought up in this council meeting. And specifically in regards to the proceedings on how this body functions and how what's post-council's role and what is post-role. So as a reminder, under 53.6.211, post-council has the authority to suspend or revoke the certification of a peace officer for various reasons, including violations of both state and federal law, Garrity, sexual conduct on duty. So it's the post council that has that authority. The division, being post, is charged with investigating the officers who are alleged to have violated 53.6.211. The division, post, uses an ALJ to determine if the allegations meet the clear and convincing standard of whether or not those allegations under 53.6.211 have been are sustained and have been met. If dismissed, the case will not come before post-council. The council must then review the findings of facts and conclusions of the law, determine the sanction, and determine whether or not to suspend or revoke or dismiss the matter. It is my advice as legal counsel for the post-council, that the council consider and adopt the findings and conclusions of law done by the ALJ. And the reason being is the ALJ, the hearings that are involved are quite lengthy and quite tedious in these matters. So, for instance, on the Heimberg matter, there was a two-day hearing on this with multiple witnesses. The evidence is quite a bit. And so the reason this was split up is so the council didn't have to hear these proceedings. The presentation of witnesses, the ALJ has the opportunity to accept presentation of witnesses, evidence, as well as making a determination of credibility of those witnesses and evidence. Again, council members may wish to disregard the ALJ's decision, but it's my advice to consider and adopt the ALJ's decision and his findings of facts and conclusion of law for appeals purposes. And if we deviate from the ALJ's decisions, it could cause issues not only for the council, but for the members themselves if they're not done in good faith. So I hope this clarifies a little bit of confusions that were put before the council earlier today. Does anybody have any questions or concerns? Seeing none, thank you.
Thank you. Director Stevenson has a little bit of business.
Yes. I'll do it from here if you don't mind, since Sheriff Decker has missed his meeting due to sickness, has a flu. But we wanted to recognize him for his service. I think, 42, 45 years in this profession is amazing. That's staying power. And I've enjoyed my relationship with Sheriff Decker and wish him well into retirement, and especially his service on the council. He always had some wise things to say, and was just very consistent, and I appreciated him for that. But with that, we got him a commemorative pen. That member, he can write in space.
Not just like a pencil.
These are in demand. Just like a pencil. These are in demand, but I thought it would be very fitting to send him off with a good memento from all of us. So that's that. And then real quick, it's not on the agenda, but it's just a matter of information. We have the new sergeant, Scott Lawrenson, who came to us from Unified Police Department. I was going to have him say a few things about some of the review process we're doing with physical fitness and the physical fitness testing.
but I have instructed him to look at specifically sit-ups. After doing some research, sit-ups were validated back in, 1981?
With so, studies from 1970-something, yeah. They just reused those.
So it's been a while, and I'm having him look at every movement that we have, we expect officers and cadets to participate in. He's very knowledgeable about physical fitness, and so I just wanted to let you know that be prepared. Probably June, we may have a new physical fitness test for your approval. But I just wanted you to know that research is being done as we speak. And that's it.
We'll move on to the election of a new vice chair. Obviously, Sheriff Decker was the vice chair and has since retired. And I would just like to add to Director Stevenson, he's been a huge addition to this council and to the state of Utah as a sheriff and a friend of law enforcement and a personal friend. So with that, we'll go ahead and open the floor for election.
For nominations.
I'd like to nominate Spencer Austin.
We have a nomination for Spencer Austin.
Second.
So we'll end up
doing the vote. But if you guys want to do an open vote, yeah.
And then do we have any other nominations? No other nominations? I'll go ahead and close that, and we'll hand out.
We don't need to waste paper.
We're probably good. Congratulations.
Excessive speech.
Yes.
What can I say? Let me save my remarks until the next meeting.
Okay. Thank you. Congratulations.
So properly prepared.
Okay, we need to schedule the next meeting. We usually do it mid-March-ish. And my budget isn't completely awful right now, but I would rather avoid paying for the expenditures attached to traveling to St. George. So if we could do it here, that would be best for post-budget.
We were just talking about that before the meeting. We want to get you the money so you can go to St. George.
Well, I'm going to use that when I testify for the legislature. Sheriff Noel, like me in St. George. When is the cheese?
Last week.
Last week?
March, yeah.
It's Western State Sheriffs, the 4th through the 8th.
Also. Oh, it's the first part.
Well, the session doesn't end until...
Session ends on the 15th.
Yeah, 15th. So what about the week of the 18th?
What day are you looking at?
The 19th?
That looks... that works.
Mm-hmm. Or the 20th. I got to be up here on the 21st anyway, so it'd be a two-day.
Oh, what day? 20th?
20th. We've got SAR reimbursement at Capitol on the 21st.
That works. Does that work for them? 20th?
20th.
It doesn't work for me, but
no, it doesn't.
I got to be in Austin that week.
19th.
That's great. Let's look at...
Do the 19th vacation.
19th, does that work, 19th?
19th.
It gets me out of a meeting with my city manager, so... maybe the last one I'll have, too. So the 19th of March at 10 a.m. post.
Is that correct?
Yeah, that works. And congratulations, Spencer, on your new appointment.
Thank you.
Now, the governor actually has approved that, is that correct?
No.
We're not on this one?
No.
Okay.
He's on the...
On this, so we're good.
He's part of the administrative position. Thank you. But if I could say something real quick.
Yeah.
Again, I appreciate you guys being on the council today, especially for the newbies. This was a grind, and there was a lot of information to process, and I appreciate your decorum and professionalism. These are not difficult decisions, and I don't think anybody on this council takes lightly the fact that we hand out and met out discipline. There should be some reverence attached to that as we make decisions, as you make decisions, and I feel like you do so, and I appreciate that.
Thank you to staff for preparing all the documents. We know it's a ton of work. We appreciate your efforts there. What's that? Oh, there is lunch.
Well, the buzzards have eaten lunch. We still have food there?
It's in the front desk.
Okay. 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 I mean, buzzer through my staff.
There's a hard roll and some water.
Thanks, Director.
Well, motion to adjourn.
Oh, motion to adjourn.
So moved.
Thank you.